Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Last night, I was asked to appear on Coast to Coast with George Norrie to talk about what had happened in Cleveland, the sexual enslavement of three young women for approximately a decade. And as I was watching all the coverage, and as I talked with some of the women in my life about it, I got a very uneasy feeling that the real issues weren't being dealt with. We were being told about the horror of this event, the potential horror, the torturing and abuse of these women. And that is, of course, just about as heinous a crime as is possible. We were asked to think about how did they persist over the years. We were asked to think about why they didn't escape or try to escape. We don't know. The Stockholm Syndrome was brought up. People asked about psychotherapy for these women and what else they would need in the future. But the huge elephant in the room, the rampant male abuse of women, was hardly mentioned. While this example of what happened in Cleveland is horrendous, there are millions of women living in their families as young children, in relationships as adults, in marriages, who are also the victims of male entitlement and abuse. The male idea of being entitled to sex and the male drive to dominate women. Looking at some of the most available data, 17% of women in a survey say they've been raped in their lifetime. Most of them before the age of 18, which again puts them in the borderline with these women who were about 18, 19, and younger. The rape of female soldiers has been increasing in the service. A particularly shocking phenomenon since there's such a sense of self-protection and protection of the group in the service. Not only was not male abuse addressed, using this as a particularly horrendous example that occurs again and again in one form or another, nor was it addressed in its more persistent, subtle forms, nor was the slave trade children discussed, nor child abuse in general. But also not discussed was the responses of women watching this. Because what I picked up and what made sense to me was that women watching this are not looking at it the way the talking heads on TV are looking at it. They're not looking at it as, what a bizarre, incomprehensible, and yet horrendous act. They're being re-stimulated on acts against themselves and their loved ones which bear similarity, including rape, including brutal relationships and marriages, including child abuse. So that's where my mind went when I went on the Coast to Coast. And George Norrie was a very caring man, responded very thoughtfully to what I was saying. It made me feel that we should call for a National Day of Male Atonement. Hardly any of us are free of male entitlement and male control. And whether we think we're free or not, it's still rampant. How about that? A National Day of Male Atonement. I don't usually begin my show so solemnly, but this has really been on my mind. Now, my guest, I have no idea whether he'll have any particular feelings about this, but I think he would be very sensitive to this. My guest is Kelly Bulkeley. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Would you say your last name for me? Make sure everybody hears it right.
Sure. It's Bulkeley. Kind of like Berkeley, but Bulkeley.
Bulkeley. But it's spelled B-U-L-K-E-L-E-Y.
That's it.
Bulkeley. Well, Kelly comes to us from an unusual route, which is his PR. Our radio show is attracting more attention from people who are promoting and selling books. And Ginger, of course, vets all this. And Kelly, as it turns out, is a really welcome guest on our show, bringing something that I have not paid enough attention to. And that is dreams. I don't know that I've had a show on dreams. Kelly's a dream researcher. He's got great credentials. He's a visiting scholar at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. His website is about dreams, and folks who want to learn more about dreams and research and dreams and really across the spectrum of psychology, religion, science, politics, culture, art. He got his doctorate in religion and psychological studies from the University of Chicago Divinity School, and then went on to study to get, what is the MTS that you got, Kelly? That's what?
Yeah, it's called a Master's of Theological Studies. It's a master's degree, yeah.
And that's from Harvard Divinity School and a BA from Stanford. You've got incredible credentials. He's former president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. He's a senior editor of the APA Journal. We'll forgive him for being a part of the establishment. APA Journal Dreams. His latest book is Children's Dreams. And one of the things I found so interesting is that he wrote it with his mother, Patricia. So, Kelly, as we talked about on the phone, we just talk. So where would you like to begin?
Well, we'll start by thanking you for the opportunity to chat with you and your listeners, and you know, I share the sentiments you mentioned at the outset of just kind of horror and you know, dismay, and yet kind of a sense of like, yeah, this isn't a surprise. You know, the story of the women being held captive in Cleveland, like, you know, yes, it's kind of a shocking thing, but yeah, at a certain level, it's not shocking. It's just more sort of extreme version of things that are happening all the time. So,
well, good. Thank you for that. I just think that men really need to have a greater regular awareness that seems very missing, both the men and the women on the Fox and CNN and whatever else I turn to, the internet. As I was getting ready to talk to folks last night on the radio. So setting that aside now, unless you can connect it to your dream work, let's hear about your work.
Yeah, well, maybe this is a segue. I you know, I don't want to, I mean, it's, you know, the book that my mother and I co-wrote is about children's dreams, which, you know, in some ways are about kind of new growth and life and development, and so it's not quite on point with some of the issues raised by the Cleveland abduction story. Although I can say that you know, from the outset of my own life trajectory in the study of dreams, I was pretty typical adolescent male when I was growing up, focused on sports and outer world things, and it was my dreams that really kind of, specifically a series of recurrent nightmares that kind of compelled me to turn within and to reflect on my own emotional life and my own relationships and interactions with people. And to me, it felt like a way that I kind of overcame some of the cultural gender programming that as a young man I was definitely taking in and acting upon. And so I refrain from ever saying, you know, dreams can solve this problem or that problem, but my sense is that for a lot of men who act out their you know, deep desires and very, you know, sort of selfish wishes and such, there could be a real disconnect there between their sort of sense of themselves in the world and what's going on within. And dreams are one way to make those connections that perhaps have been broken in modern society.
Well, good. Let's talk some more about that, about dreams, modern society. I really want to open the mic to you to talk about what matters to you about dreams.
Well, yeah, that's, I mean, I guess, you know, starting with the premise of this book that we were on, Children's Dreams, basic idea is that in contemporary Western society, we don't pay a whole lot of attention to dreams. We relegate them to kind of the refuse bin. You know, if you're psychologically, you know, if you're having problems and you need to go to a shrink or something, then maybe worry about your dreams. But otherwise, you know, there's nothing you should really be worrying about with them. And that's, I guess, culturally what I've found is that's a very specific point of view, and that other cultures and other places and times around the world, people have recognized that dreams are, you know, one of the ways that we know the world. And so, you know, part of what we try to do in this book is suggest to parents, hey, you can help your kids, you know, reconnect with a really deep and ancient source of guidance and you know, psychological wisdom simply by paying attention to dreams, you know, not even you know, analyzing them in some elaborate way or interpreting them in some really clever way, but simply allowing some space for the dreaming imagination to come into your life and your awareness. And starting that in childhood, our sense is, you know, of a potentially powerful agent of change in our society in terms of promoting greater, you know, self-awareness and emotional intelligence and empathetic connections with others.
Well, you know, I like empathy. How do dreams get us empathically in touch with others? I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, it's actually that's a great question, because it highlights how, I mean, there's a sort of stereotype about dreams that, oh, they're just sort of crazy nonsense and nothing makes, you know, it's all just jumbled, garbled, fragmented, disordered brain functioning. And in fact, you know, when you actually look at dreams and study large collections of dreams, you realize that there's a great deal of structure and sort of continuity and coherence to our dreams. Many of the mental abilities we have in the waking world, we also have in dreaming. And one of those is empathy, is, you know, the technical term would be theory of mind, right? That we're able in dreams to recognize that other people are other people and have interests and motivations and such. And so, you know, at the simplest level, you know, I have some colleagues who have done this kind of work with people from different economic backgrounds or racial backgrounds, where if you look at dreams and you realize, well, I had a dream of a, you know, person that I would never see in the waking world, or I don't like, or I, you know, I stay away from, but wow, there they were in my dream, and I was interacting with them and kind of getting along with them. Huh, what do you know? Like, maybe that person is a human being like I am. So dreams can simulate interactions and encounters with you know, quote unquote, others, with people that we demonize or we disown as having any relation to us, can present them in a way that enhances our respect for them as other humans. And I can give a personal example of this. This goes back some years and reveals a little bit, I suppose, about me. But I tend to be on the leftward side of the political spectrum. But from time to time, I'll have dreams of political figures on the right. And one that comes to mind several years ago was with Newt Gingrich, where I had a very vivid dream of Newt Gingrich. And in waking life, you know, I could, if I saw him on TV or if he's talking, I just turn the channel. Just like, I can't, this guy just can't even stand him. But in this dream, he and I were having a discussion, and we were kind of going back and forth, and he was making his points and I was trying to make my points. And when I woke up, I was, you know, it's not like I went out and re-registered as a Republican or anything, but I realized, like, wow, I've been demonizing him. I've been regarding him as this kind of alien, evil being. And in this dream, I was kind of called to task for that. It's like, well, you know what? He's a human being. He's got his point of view, and you can interact with him and have a conversation. And it doesn't mean you hold hands and sing kumbaya, but you can get beyond that kind of alienated, dehumanized point of view towards that person. And that I think, in a, you know, kind of a microcosm, illustrates the potential of dreaming to push us beyond the barriers that we consciously create for ourselves about who's good and who's bad and who's in and who's out, and help us reflect on that and be more intentional and conscious about it.
That is so interesting in so many different ways. Gosh, I get about 10 thoughts from all this. I'm going to avoid taking over.
No, go ahead.
One of my thoughts is that, in fact, the demonizing of the right is a profound aspect of many people on the left. And I grew up in a liberal family in the 50s, 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. and Jewish family. To some extent, Christians were being demonized, but wholly demonized were people who were on the right, or even individualists. I think it's so interesting that your dream is addressing that. People on the right, in my experience, do not demonize the left in the same way. They think of the people on the left as just not understanding basic principles of life. They don't, like personal responsibility and the Constitution and so on. But people on the left do tend to demonize the right, and I think that's so interesting. But I don't generally get much into politics on the show, but I think that is very interesting. From the psychological viewpoint, what really interests me is that I've never thought about dreams in the way you are, which may say something about myself. The standard stock approach to dreams usually has to do with a very self-centered idea. I've even heard dream analysts say that everybody in the dream is the dreamer.
Yeah.
And of course, Freud thought of dreams as wish fulfillment of a very personal, instinctive kind. So the idea that empathy is experienced in dreams, I think, is amazing and interesting. And can you give more examples? Do you have examples from children? Or how much? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what you bring up is a sense that, again, you know, in Western psychological terminology, you know, there's been a kind of a shrinking of the relevance of dreaming to the purely subjective.
Exactly.
And so, for example, you know, like kind of coming back to what we were talking about, like if a person dreams of, you know, say being sexually abused, well, we might say, oh, well, you know, that's just kind of, you know, a metaphor for the inner sexual abuse that you know, or I don't know. You can spin out a kind of a subjective interpretation of that pretty easily, but you might also think, well, huh, does this reflect, you know, a social environment in which that individual is having that dream? And my background is primarily in the history of dreaming and looking at dream teachings and practices cross culturally. And so, you know, that my religious studies background was really just kind of an excuse to study dreams in all cultures and all places as much as I could. And what I really took from that was that Western psychology is unusual in restricting the significance of dreaming to the individual, to, you know, a purely egotistical interest. And it's not that that's not a dimension of dreaming. But in most other cultures, there's a sense that there are dreams that are relevant more broadly, that are relevant to your family, to your community, to your faith tradition, and if we don't sort of acknowledge that and recognize that within ourselves, we almost cut off our own inner resource. We almost cut off a really powerful means of perceiving the world and making sense of the world. So, it's, you know, another way of framing this is to look at sort of the human tendency to project generally, that we look at the world through the lens of our own biases and prejudices, and sometimes that's helpful. That can kind of help guide us through uncertain situations, but if we're not careful about it, it can lead us into all sorts of trouble. So this is where you know, I'm a real big believer in promoting you know, greater dream awareness in childhood and onward. Not so much as, you know, well, what does this dream mean or what does that dream mean, but are you in touch with your own dreaming imagination? Are you open to what comes out of your dreams? And is your waking awareness flexible enough to, you know, incorporate and integrate some of the seemingly crazy things that come up from our dreams, but that are actually, I think, broadening our perspective in a helpful way? So,
where does Jung fit into this? In terms, I think he used dreams to look into what he felt was the collective unconscious that could have an aspect of empathy and caring to it, but I don't know. Where does Jung fit in?
Yeah, well, he Carl Jung, of course, was one of the early followers of Sigmund Freud, and so learned a lot of Freud's ideas about dreams, but then went off on his own path. And what I like about Jung is his basic distinction between what he called big and little dreams, and that's something we talk about a lot in this book. We really focus on so-called big dreams of childhood, and the distinction there is that little dreams tend to be relatively trivial and mundane and kind of about day-to-day stuff and probably not especially memorable. You might, you know, remember for a little bit, but probably gone soon after waking, whereas a big dream tends to be relatively rare but is extraordinarily impactful, and you literally can't forget it. One of the dreams, a very very short dream image, but one that we talk about in the book. A woman had a dream when she was 5 years old, and she could still remember this particular image when she was 95. So 90 years later, she still remembers a childhood dream, and so there's something. I think Jung was right that when our dreaming imaginations, when the brain-mind processes that generate dreams, you know, when they go to the trouble of creating a dream that has that much impact, that much sort of, you know, power and emotional intensity, there's usually something worth looking into and engaging with. So that's the that's kind of the starting point, and we take that from Jung. And it's not like Jung was right about everything. I mean, Jung, you know, like everybody had his better points and weaker points, but on that one, I think he was very insightful. And pretty much all the dreams we talk about in this particular book are what Jung would call big dreams from childhood, dreams that have made a lasting impact on the child and then the adult's conscious awareness. And you know, a lot of it, you know, coming back to your interest in sort of the empathy point, I mean, a lot of the things that happen in dreams are about our relationships. And with children, that often revolves around their parents and their siblings. I can't imagine a therapist, who could be working with a client and not have at least a little bit of interest in what that client is dreaming about or has dreamed. You know, wouldn't you want to know if your client, you know, had an incredibly impactful and memorable dream back when they were a child? Like, wouldn't that be a interesting point of information to have if you were a therapist trying to help that person with whatever's going on? So, I think that there's a lot of a lot to learn from these kinds of dreams, and yet, you know, like I said at the outset, Western society, whether it's because we're more individualistic or we're more rationalistic, or, you know, I know you're quite interested in the impact of psychoactive medications, I think that clearly is having all sorts of impact on people's dream recall and their sleep patterns and such in ways that I don't think are often helpful to remembering dream and taking them seriously.
We have a caller who apparently has a question pertaining to the show.
Well, there you go.
Sarah, are you on the line?
Yes. Hi, Kelly. It's Sarah Lev.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Hanging in there?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm a teacher. I'm on a break right now, and I have to get my kids, but I thought I would listen for a little bit. I just had a comment. It wasn't necessarily a question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So I was actually thinking about the empathy piece, and I have a son who's now 6, and I have a 1-year-old, and it was really interesting. Maybe a month ago or so, he had a dream that my second son was stolen out of the crib.
Hmm.
And they share a room, and it was just, I just connected it to the empathy because it actually began a really good discussion between us about those fears of what he thinks it's like to be a baby and why he's afraid for his brother and how could he protect him. And, you know, of course it was related to his fears, but I think it also brought out a discussion about how it feels to be a baby.
Yeah.
and what it feels, and you had just brought up about being a sibling and the fears related to that. So I think it told me about how he was feeling about being a brother, but also it helped us to talk about the relationship. So it was really, it was a nice entryway to that. So I just wanted to bring that up.
How interesting. And so he dreamed that it wasn't, he wasn't being kidnapped. It was the baby brother.
Yeah.
Being kidnapped.
Yeah. He woke. He said, "I had a nightmare, and my son is Chaplin." He said, "Chaplin was stolen from his crib."
Wow.
And then he said, "What are we going to do, Mommy? What are we going to do if someone tries to steal him?"
Yeah.
From the crib. So.
Yeah. Wow. Well. Thanks for sharing that, because that's a. I mean, sounds scary for him, but it sounds like you handled
it. Yeah, we talked about it. So anyway,
was there anything, Sarah?
Yeah.
Sarah, was there anything in his life that may have provoked that at the time? Something he saw on TV or family discussion?
No. I mean, he's becoming more aware of the world. I mean, he's 6, and I think it was sort of a natural dream to have. I don't think it was spurred on by anything in particular, just an awareness of there's this other creature living with me and sleeping next to me, and I think it's and also his awareness of a baby's kind of powerlessness in the world and how he might want to protect him.
Right.
You know, I think he sees his role. His role has now changed, being a big brother.
Exactly.
And I think he feels a sense of protection for him. And I think that dream kind of just brought it out, and it really helped me to understand how he was feeling. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
It's very relevant, very relevant to our conversation. I appreciate you calling in. So don't usually take calls unless they're really spot on. Often don't take them at all. So thank you for joining
us. Yeah, absolutely. I got to go get my kids, but thanks so much, Kelly. Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, oh, good hearing from you. Yeah. Well,
Take care.
That's a great illustration of how, you know, in this case, a child, you know, having a sibling, you know, enter the world, suddenly the six-year-old's role and identity changes, even though, you know, he didn't do anything, but suddenly, wow, I've got a younger brother. That means I'm now an older brother. And from what I could...
But you know, Kat, we're reading an awful lot into it. Freud would have probably said that he wanted to kill his little sibling and had a dream about his disappearing.
Sure. Oh, sure. right. Well, which I think, and Freud, you know, that, to be honest, that crossed my mind as well, and I thought back to when
And I don't know. I'm not pretending. I don't know. We should be probably going to break. I think our engineer kindly let us run over because of the good call. But we'll be going to break in a minute. But so it both entered our minds. But it really shows how caring this mom is and how eager and willing she is to create a loving environment in the home. I really like that. And and she's seeing this in a very benevolent and caring way, the dream.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And channeling that sibling rivalry in a constructive direction.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, why don't we go to break, folks?
All right.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. My guest is Kelly Bulkley, PhD, spelled B-U-L-K-E-L-E-Y, as she says, kind of like Berkeley, but Bulkley. And he's got a website all about dreams, and he's got a book, a latest book, Children's Dreams, which he wrote with his mom, Patricia. I would kind of like to hear about writing a book with your mom, if you feel like talking about that.
Oh, sure.
Another thing I'd like to hear about is if you have any kind of rich conception of what dreams are. What are they?
Yeah.
Physiologically, psychologically, spiritually.
Yeah.
So there's two thoughts for you to mull and respond to.
Sure. Of course, Freud would be quite interested in the the creative collaboration I have with my mother, but that's okay. She and I, my mother is a former hospice chaplain, a Presbyterian minister. This is actually the children's dream book is the second book we've written together. We wrote a book called Dreaming Beyond Death, a guide to pre-death dreams and visions. We wrote that, I think it was 2006. And as I said, my mother is a hospice chaplain, and when she was getting her Doctor of Ministry degree many years ago, she was working and doing her project on the dreams and visions that people that she worked with in the final weeks and days and hours of their lives, they were often telling her these just amazing dreams that were in a way kind of preparing them for death and what was to come after death, however they conceived that. And I said to my mom, I said, wow, this is great stuff. She should really write a book. You know, this is people are going to love this. And she's like, oh, I don't know how to write a book. You've got to help me. I can't do this. And you know, I like to think of myself as a dutiful son. So I said, sure, I can add some things to this and help make it all work. And so we did that project together, and it went well. But it was also kind of a kind of an intense subject. I mean, people kind of terminal illness and struggling with you know, their final sense of life and meaning and what lies beyond life. So we thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to do a project that was kind of on the lighter side of things, or the kind of not sort of leading into death, but kind of leading more into life? And then we thought, well, the early dreams of childhood are kind of a bookend to that project, in the sense that the Dreaming Beyond Death book was about the dreams at the very end of life, and what we've written in this book about children's dreams are about the dreams that kind of herald the beginning of life, or kind of the emergence of consciousness and self-awareness at the beginning of life. So it's been a lot of fun. We get along well. You know, our family's been very supportive, and you know, my wife and my mom's husband, my dad, have all been supportive, and it's all been good. So I can't say there have been any, you know, horrible Oedipal dynamics that have made it problematic or anything.
You don't have to be self-conscious of me. I never think in Freudian terms. The only reason I brought it up today is is because of the dream issues, and of course he wrote the first great dream book in the Western psychological world. I'm very, very close. My parents are gone. I'm very close to Ginger's mom, Jean, whom I love very, very much. So don't have to have any embarrassment about that. Can you talk some more about the this idea of the dreams preparing people for death? And if you can actually think of some, recall some, that would be really interesting. And maybe also, you know, move on to the children's dreams, preparing them for life. I love this idea.
Yeah, well, and you would also ask, you know, kind of a general sense of what dreams are about. And I, kind of way of getting into that, I could say that, you know, my sense at this point is the best way to understand what dreams are is to think of them as a kind of play, that our minds engage in while we sleep. I think the analogy, you know, sometimes people say, you know, dreams are just crazy random nonsense and just neural firings of the brain while we sleep. You know, and I think those are probably the same people that if you brought them to, like, you know, your local public school, say, or grammar school at lunchtime, and the kids are all out running around at recess, you know, they'd look and they'd say, oh, that's just a bunch of random nonsense out there. That's just, you know, crazy, chaotic, you know, disjointed, fragmented. Nothing really is happening out there, is there? Well, if you paid, you know, a few minutes of attention, you'd realize, no, you know, children, when they're playing, it's highly structured, it's highly intentional. There's all sorts of meanings and intentions and goals and, you know, victories and defeats and joys and tragedies. I mean, you know, children's play encompasses the world in a way that not only the world as it is, but the world as it might be, as it could be. So I think of dreaming as what our minds do when we are on recess. You know, like we go to sleep, we leave the waking world, the social world behind us, and within the space of our own sleeping imagination, we're able to play, to explore, to sort through the experiences we've had from the previous day, to reflect on things that might have been challenging or exciting or puzzling, and to try out different possibilities, to see what might happen. You know, what would happen if I did this? What would happen if I did that? What would happen if, you know, any of a number of things happened, and kind of see what would happen, see where it might lead. And in that sense, the what I kind of referred to with the preparation, you know, the dreaming beyond death, and this is definitely true with children's dreams as well. We, in both cases, we rely quite a bit on a theory known as the threat simulation theory of dreaming, which neuroscientist in Finland named Antti Ravansuo has developed with his colleagues. And the basic idea is that what dreaming is doing, I think it's a version of my sort of play perspective, but what Ravansuo says is that dreaming prepares us for the kinds of threats and dangers that we humans typically face in our waking lives. And by anticipating those threats and dangers, by creating simulations of them in our imagination and playing with different responses and different ways of dealing with them, we wake up better prepared to deal with that kind of situation in our waking lives. And so, you know, in the case of the Dreaming Beyond Death book, you know, people, as they're, you know, they've received a terminal illness diagnosis, they know they're about to die, and their dreams try to help them make some sense of that. And again, you know, from a Freudian perspective, it can all be wish fulfillment. That's fine. You know, sometimes creating vivid scenarios of wishes can have certain psychological benefits. It can also have very practical benefits in terms of making us more aware of what is actually happening in the waking world, rather than turning us away. I think as Freud's notion was, a kind of, you know, it's kind of a defensive, trying to reject reality. We see these kinds of dreams as better preparing people for reality. And again, I can give a pretty simple example from my own experience just as a parent, and this kind of goes along with the children's dreams theme. You know, oftentimes as my children have been growing up, I've had dreams about them, and sometimes really scary dreams where, you know, something bad will happen. They'll be kidnapped, you know, sort of like the kid's dream that we heard earlier, or there'll be an accident, or they'll be lost, or a wave will come up and sweep them away. And when I wake up from those dreams, I'm relieved that it was just a dream, you know, that isn't actually happening. But I can guarantee you that my waking awareness for the rest of that day is much more attuned to protecting my kids, that I'm much more vigilant, I'm much more sensitive to possible dangers and threats. And it's not like I'm ignoring them otherwise, but my point is that certain dreams can have the impact of heightening our vigilance towards waking world dangers and threats in a way that can better prepare us to handle those and deal with them adaptively and effectively. And so I guess where my kind of dreaming is play idea builds on that is, I think that dreams not only simulate threats and dangers, I think they also simulate hopes and possibilities and potentials, that it's not only, you know, nightmarish stuff that we have to worry about, but sometimes dreaming of what might lie ahead, what possible new paths for growth and development a person might have in their lives, and playfully imagining what that might be like. I think that's a big part of what our dreams are doing.
All that's, you know, consistent with how I think the human mind works, consciously, yeah, unconsciously. One of the ways I view dreams, which is totally consistent with what you're saying, but perhaps broader, is simply that dreams are stories we tell ourselves. So what's the story about?
Yeah.
And, of course, the story can be about disaster. The story can be about growth and development. The story can be about working through things. So I view them as creative productions, like one would view poetry or other forms of literature or expression.
Right, right.
Which leaves it way open for exploration by the individual.
Exactly. Yeah, well, and one way of actually kind of illustrating just what you're saying is the research on post-traumatic stress disorder nightmares. And I'm guessing, you know, your listeners are somewhat familiar with the idea that when people have suffered a terrible trauma, whether it's a, you know, a wartime thing or a sexual attack or a terrible car accident, say, that one of the symptoms of the kind of the traumatic experience is repetitive nightmares that just graphically replay just kind of over and over again that traumatic experience. And what research has shown that people over time, people who have suffered a trauma like that, usually if they've had some help, some therapy, some kind of counseling, but it seems like there's a kind of a natural process where those nightmares change, and they become more story-like. They become less kind of graphic replayings of that traumatic event just kind of hitting you on the head again and again and again. But the traumatic, the details and the feelings of the traumatic experience get kind of woven into other stories, other kinds of dream scenarios. And that kind of transition from the graphic replayings to the more story-like, you know, regular kind of dreams seems to be an indication of healing, that the person is kind of integrating that traumatic experience and weaving it into the ongoing story of their life, of who they are and how they make sense of the world. So I think you're absolutely right that there's that at a certain level dreams are stories we tell ourselves, and a traumatic experience can sometimes, you know, how do you even tell us, like, you know, somebody said, you know, there can be no poetry after the Holocaust, right? I might be mangling that quote, but something to that effect, where when something so traumatic happens, has it exceeded our ability to integrate it within a story? And I think that that's very much what dreams are up to, is trying to help us, you know, craft our experiences into meaningful stories that help us move ahead with our lives and find as much fulfillment and satisfaction as we all can together.
Well, I think what you're saying is very, very interesting, and I think people are going to benefit from hearing it. I see in my practice that dreams will do just what you're saying. They will mature from chaotic, scary, difficult to explain, weird experiences, which the person wakes up uncomfortably from, or scared from, to dreams that are more about the real issues in the person's life, where they can identify, oh, I'm frightened because of the things we were dealing with, or I'm actually excited in that dream because of what's going on in my life, that the dream becomes more integrated with life. And that's a nice observation. I think it's important. I also think it's interesting that, you know, the unconscious works in the same way during sleep, whether or not we know we're dreaming. I mean, I will often wake up with solutions to how I want to approach a problem, a book to write, something I forgot to do. And it's clear. So clearly I've been busy at night, even though I haven't dreamed about it. I don't know if there's much to work with there to discuss the unconscious versus the dream life, or being the same as the dream life.
Yeah, well, it. I mean, dreams, this is one of the reasons, you know, we're talking a lot about Freud today, but I mean, that, you know, why he called dreams, you know, the royal road to a knowledge of the unconscious mind, is that dreams are kind of a natural, you know, sort of everybody, within everybody's experience, way of connecting with their unconscious mind. And it's not the only way, and it's not that, you know, everything there is in the unconscious expresses itself in dreams, but it reveals that there's more to who we are than just our waking conscious ego. And for some people, you know, this is why they don't like dreams, you know, and why dreams have kind of a, you know, suspicious reputation out there. Because, you know, if put it this way, if you're a person who's very invested in kind of the status quo of who you are and what you are and the position you hold in the world, and you really, you know, hold tightly to that, dreams aren't going to be your friend, really, because dreams are rarely about what is. They're more about what might be. And so, you know, like I said, if you're really invested in the status quo, dreams are going to mess with that. They're going to challenge that. They're going to poke at that and say, wow, well, that's the way things are now, but huh, they could be different. And for some people, they don't like to think about things being different, you know, so that's...
I think also another way to look at it a little more positively on behalf of some of those folks is that if you're looking at life as mastery, you're looking at life as achievement and control,
right,
then it's a little scary to deal with that which is out of your control or feels out of your control,
exactly,
which are the dreams. And I think that there is almost a conflict in a way between viewing life in terms of mastery and viewing life in terms of dream, And I think that it's possibly the difference to some extent between the poet and the activist.
Right.
Whatever broad general categories, without saying one is better than the other. I think that people can not be particularly in touch with dreams because they are very reality focused, have things they want to achieve, and so on, whereas people
right.
can also be in touch more with their dream life because that's more what they're about, with their own
sure.
personal creativity and so on.
Yeah.
What about dreams and psychosis? I tend to often view people having hallucinations, and particularly if these hallucinations become very nightmarish hallucinations, which people can get in the evenings in particular, because that's so often when abuse took place in their lives as children.
Right.
They have nightmarish hallucinatory, auditory, visual even experiences. And they seem so much like dreams to me. And again, I think there's a very close connection between what we call losing touch with reality and getting into a dream state while we're awake. Thoughts
yeah.
on that, sir?
Yeah, well, there's sort of a historical, you know, intuition that dreaming is a kind of normal madness we all engage in every night. So there is a sense in which when we're asleep and dreaming, our mind is a little crazy. It's not structured by the sort of usual framework of our rational waking ego. But when people are, I guess if I'm understanding your question right, I think that there's a definitely a sense in which if that kind of dreaming process kind of breaks its bounds, you know, and sort of pushes into the waking world in a disruptive way, or a way that you know, kind of rather than enhancing the ego's ability to function, disrupts it and fragments it, and that's a real problem. I you know, I think it's pretty clear when people who are suffering some kind of serious psychological problem, their dreams become very, you know, truly disordered. I mean, I kind of push back against the idea that dreams are crazy in and of themselves, because actually, you know, a very high percentage of dreams, if you just read the dream report, didn't know it was a dream, you know, you wouldn't know if that was a dream or just somebody's description of something they just did that day. You know, dreams are actually pretty realistic mm-hmm. and good representations of our experiences, but sometimes they go, you know, far beyond that, and I think when people are having some kind of, you know, severe psychological problem, their dreams are almost always going to be, you know, badly disrupted as well.
One way I look at it is when you think about flashbacks from post-traumatic issues. I don't call them disorders, because I think that the post-traumatic reactions are normal people with normal brains reacting to
right.
horrific stresses, that there's a close correspondence between dream nightmare and awakening, and a person can relive in a nightmare the abuse or the war, and I mean, over the whole spectrum of life, it can go
right.
back to your childhood when you were abused, or
right.
it could be something more recent. Then you awaken, and one still feels in the dream during awake, and at times one gets flashbacks while wholly awake and not even particularly near being asleep, but being overstimulated by
right.
something that brings the flashback. So I'm not sure I've quite thought this through quite like this before, but I think that the flashback phenomena and the overwhelming sense that people will get when they're awake of being terrorized and fearful and frightened because of horrific trauma they've been through, that it's all one fabric of our deepest responses to threat and to trauma. Am I making sense?
Yeah,
rolling about with these ideas.
Yeah, well, it's. I mean, we're getting into topics where the boundaries, you know, between sort of waking and dreaming, where the, you know, conscious and unconscious get kind of blurry, you know, when in a situation of, you know, the real trauma, those boundaries get shaken pretty badly and ruptured in many cases.
Have you dealt with, we only have about a minute and a half, so this I want a quick response to.
Sure.
Have you dealt with hypnagogic images, the falling asleep phenomena of having what is a borderline hallucinatory dreamlike experience? Very common, hypnagogic images.
Yeah. No, those are often quite vivid and detailed, and they I think illustrate how, you know, because that's certainly a phase of the sleep cycle right at the beginning when people are not in REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. So that to me is evidence that the brain is kind of dreaming and creating these images whether or not REM sleep is going on. So dreaming is more complicated than just REM sleep physiology.
Yeah. See, I don't have a great dream from my childhood, but throughout, I guess, my adolescence and into the first few years of college, I would have an experience when I went to sleep that I called the golden book experience, where I would have, the room would become, as I'm falling asleep, would become golden and lit, and I would be reading from a great book with great meaning, and I was seeking that meaning, and then I would sort of get awake trying to find the meaning, and I never found the meaning in the imagery, the hypnagogic imagery, although I tried to even get back and find it, but I think it's what my life has been in part about, finding all that meaning.
Fascinating.
Hey, Kelly Bulkley, B-U-L-K-E-L-E-Y, Ph.D. You can find him on the web. It's been a delight to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you.